on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake. There's nothing more for any.
Welcome back. Today is Friday, March 17th, and I'm Emma Loy.
And I'm Yushen Tsai. You are listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:04 and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
To start the show, we have a report by News 101 co-director Andrew Seal and News 101 reporters Sharon Nadim and Holly McKenzie on Don Cherry Night, an evening organized by the Kidney Foundation in collaboration with the Cherry family to raise awareness on organ donation.
Following that, we have News co-director Sahar Asaf's interview with former Vancouver councillor and co-chair of the Women Transforming Cities Society, Ellen Woodsworth. Ellen talks about how cities can better accommodate women and girls.
Then we have Alex Norman's weekly financial news report on the biggest finance stories of the week.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, this year's AMS elections had a voter turnout of almost 21%, a noticeable increase from the past 2 years. This surpasses the 20% voter turnout goal set by the AMS Elections Committee during the council meeting. Compared to 2016's 12.5% turnout and 2015's 12.9% turnout, this goal seemed especially ambitious. Max Holmes, this year's elections administrator, attributes the increase to a change in the allocation of the 3,500 advertising budget, where 90% of the money was focused on getting people to vote rather than attend events. Holmes added, quote, having more advertising on social media and things that people are more regularly using and that they can just click to go to the website and vote definitely helped with turnout this year, end quote. The polling stations were also placed differently this year, with a greater emphasis on placing stations in first-year residences. In addition, all four referendums put forward this year passed with quorum. Moving forward, Holmes emphasizes the importance of keeping the same budget and advertising focus. Quote, I hope that what this year can start is a gradual trend upwards, where we have a little bit higher turnout every single year, end quote. Last week, from March 3rd to 11th, UBC's Pride Collective hosted Pride Week. Emily Lin, a third-year biology major and appointed member of the Pride Collective Events Committee, calls Pride Week a celebration of our identities. The week began with a flag-raising ceremony and went on to host many events. A small fair was set up on Wednesday in the Nest, where booths included our very own CITR 101.9 giving out zines that they had produced, and others selling succulents and crafts made by LGBTQ plus folks. On Thursday, a Pride Week performance was held featuring poets, such as the reigning Vancouver Poetry Slam champion Santiago Ureña. Coral Moore also performed, reading poems about the UBC Free Speech Club and trans issues in Vancouver. Other events included an academic conference called Queer U, a Social Justice 101 workshop, a performance night, and a dance to cap off the week. Lim noted that the Pride Collective hopes in the future to have a table in the Nest in weeks leading up to it, as well as a stronger presence throughout posters, adding, quote, we want to maintain our activist roots while evolving to fulfill the needs of the general queer and trans community at UBC, end quote. Pride Week's full schedule and additional details can be found on the Pride Collective's Facebook page.
In local news, BC extends exemption program on foreign buyer tax to encourage skilled workers from abroad. After a series of taxes imposed on foreign buyers has cooled down the housing market, the province has decided to grant exemptions, BC Premier Christy Clark announced on Friday. According to Finance Minister Mike DeJong said, the province, quote, is now in a position to provide targeted relief to help ensure our province continues to attract skilled workers and entrepreneurs, end quote. In February, the government had also announced tax exemptions for foreign nationals in Metro Vancouver holding a work visa. Under the new plan, people who arrived in BC on the provincial nominee program after August 2nd, 2016, when the tax took effect, will be able to apply for retroactive exemptions also. Vancouver's City Hall has updated its restroom signage to indicate that trans people are welcome. The new signage, which is part of the city's Supporting Trans Equality and an Inclusive Vancouver Action Plan, will also be installed at other city-owned buildings over the next few months. Quote, everyone has the right to safe and inclusive washroom facilities. This change is another step forward towards ensuring equality and inclusion for all, end quote. Vancouver City Manager Sadu Johnston said in the release, quote, this updated signage aims to help transgender variant and two-spirit individuals feel safer accessing the washroom facility they most identify with, end quote. The Supporting Trans Equality and an Inclusive Vancouver Action Plan includes a number of recommendations approved by Council in July 2016 aimed at creating a safe and inclusive Vancouver for transgender variant and two-spirit individuals.
In national news, yesterday, Transportation Minister Marc Garneau announced new regulations for drone operators. A number of laws are now in place to prevent people from flying drones dangerously. Bans have been placed on flying drones that weigh over 250 grams within 9 kilometers of airports and within 75 meters of buildings, vehicles, boats, animals, or people. People who break these new regulations can be fined up to $3,000. Many of these regulations existed previously as guidelines, but were not necessarily enforceable by law. The transportation minister hopes these new laws will allow the drone industry to grow in a responsible and safe way. However, complaints about the new rules are starting to pour in, as large parts of many cities will be drone-free, effective immediately. Senator Don Meredith said he's not ready to resign despite calls for him to step down following his recent admission of having a sexual relationship with a teen. The Senate Ethics Commissioner said that Meredith failed to uphold the highest standards of dignity, and claimed that Meredith used his prestige and power to lure the young woman in. Meredith's lawyer issued a statement asserting that while the allegations against Meredith are a moral failing, they are not a legal failing. Meredith apologized publicly yesterday to his family, the teen in question, and to the Senate, and asked for forgiveness. Legal charges have not been laid by the teen, though police could choose to lay charges independently. The Senate may have the power to expel Meredith with a vote, though senators are rarely removed from office. Meredith has spoken out, saying that racism plays a role in the attention being given to the affair.
In international news, U.S. President Trump's second travel ban was blocked by federal judges this week. Judges in both Hawaii and Maryland struck down the ban before it could start being enforced. The ban would have blocked any new visas being issued to nationals of Libya, Syria, Yemen, Iran, Sudan, and Somalia for 90 days. The White House spent several weeks carefully crafting the bill, attempting to prevent it being struck down in a similar way to the administration's first travel ban. It is expected that the White House will appeal the rulings. Trump said the ban was needed to protect Americans from, quote, radical Islamic terrorists, end quote, vowing to take the case all the way to the Supreme Court. The administration is expected to argue that the president has the authority to regulate immigration and that this ban focuses on people who are not yet in the United States. Lawyers in all in all the cases against the ban, made the same argument, that as a presidential candidate, Trump was explicit in saying he wanted to ban Muslim immigrants and require those already in the country to register. Diplomatic tensions between Turkey and the EU skyrocketed over the weekend after the Netherlands blocked Turkish officials from holding political rallies over the weekend. The planned rallies were intended to increase support for a controversial upcoming referendum that would greatly expand President Erdogan's powers. Recent polls are indicating a tight race leading the government to appeal to the Turkish diaspora in Europe for support. The Dutch government cited, quote, risks to public order and security, end quote, after preventing two Turkish ministers from entering the country. Erdogan reacted by comparing the Dutch to Nazi remnants, calling them fascists, echoing similar statements made against Germany last week. German Chancellor Angela Merkel came out in support of the Netherlands on Monday, despite her government insisting it has no plans to ban Turkish officials campaigning in the country. 3 million people of Turkish descent live in Germany, of whom 1.4 million are eligible to vote in the referendum. Germany also needs Turkey's support to keep the flow of migrants into Europe under control. The Dutch general election took place 5 days later, with incumbent Mark Rutte taking first place despite moderate gains by the far-right Party for Freedom.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
On Friday, March 17th, come out to the Polish Community Center to join CITR and Discorder in celebrating our community's generosity and hard work with the Fundrive finale.
Featuring one-off, never-heard-before performances by Tim the Mute, Hick, Puzzlehead, Ashley Shadow, Swim Team, and Missy D and Lady Jams.
Can't make it out? The night will be live broadcast at 101.9 FM and at CITR.ca. And for the first time ever, it will be streaming live on video.
There will also be a very special publication featuring poetry and visual art from the performers, free with entry.
Tickets are $10 in advance and $12 at the door, with all proceeds going towards CITR's fund drive. I'm a grown woman, and that's what's up.
Welcome back. First up, we have a report by News 101 co-director Andrew Seal and News 101 reporters Sharon Nadim and Holly McKenzie on Don Cherry Night, an event organized by the Kidney Foundation in collaboration with the Cherry family to raise awareness on organ donation.
This isn't a typical Tuesday night game for the Vancouver Giants. Players and fans are dressed in the style of Canadian icon Don Cherry to raise awareness about organ donation. The Giants teamed up with the Kidney Foundation and the Cherry family for Don Cherry Night in an effort to use Canada's favorite pastime to save lives. At center ice, Cindy Cherry dropped the puck for the game between the Giants and the Victoria Royals. Beyond her love for hockey, Cherry, who works for the Kidney Foundation, has a personal reason to be here.
My real heart belongs to them because I donated my kidney to my brother in 1979.
For the past 40 years, Cherry, along with her family, have been advocates for raising donation rates in Canada, which is currently ranked 23rd in the world. Pia Schindler, executive director of the Kidney Foundation's BC branch, hopes to use events like Don Cherry Night to improve Canada's ranking.
In British Columbia right now, 22% of the population is registered, and yet 95% say when they're polled that they're in favor of organ donation. So there's this huge gap, and what we're trying to do, for example, in working with the Vancouver Giants and with the Don Cherry family, is to just get people to be aware that it takes 2 minutes to go online and register.
One huge barrier keeping Canada's numbers low is a lack of public awareness.
There's some myths around organ donation registration. So in British Columbia, for example, a lot of people think that that they are already registered, because years ago you could sign up. It was done through the motor vehicle branch, through ICBC. So now, just lately, ICBC has embraced this again and is promoting organ donation when people renew their licenses at vehicle branches. So it's the ability and the touch points to sign up. Oftentimes there are cultural traditions where people traditionally have not considered organ donation registration. So it's, for us, we think it's really important that folks who are younger, if they embrace the concept, they take it home and they're talking about it at the family dinner table, and it can become normalized.
When asked what universities like UBC can do to support the cause, Schindler suggested that historically, universities have been successful sites for new health initiatives.
Years ago at the universities, they embraced giving blood. Now it's become a normal thing to do. This is what we envision maybe one day could happen at the universities when it comes to organ donation registration.
The foundation's goal is to increase organ donations by 50% over the next 5 years. For Jordan Marcia, those statistics aren't just numbers. After undergoing a heart transplant as a young child, he's been given a second chance at life from someone he will never know.
Yeah, so I never really got to know my donor. I've reached out on multiple occasions, starting from when I was a kid, all the way up to about a year ago. The only information I was actually allowed to have was the number that my donor got. So I have that, and I keep that close to my heart.
As a volunteer and a lifelong Giants fan, Marcia is overwhelmed at the support.
This is the first time I have volunteered for this organization. I spend most of my time actually traveling. So this is the first time I actually reached out to the foundation, to the Kidney Foundation, and to the BC Transplant Research Foundation, to ask how I can actually be a part of the whole volunteering aspect, how I can really talk about the importance of organ donation and the importance of really getting yourself on the donor list so people like me and other people out in the world can actually have a second chance at life.
Marcia is one of the thousands of people whose lives are saved by organ donation. Cherry says her family naturally gravitated towards hockey to get as many eyes as possible towards the cause.
My family thought, you know what, because we're so close to hockey, maybe that is the backbone of Canada, that because, you know, we are so Canadians are so hockey orientated. You know, we have NHL teams, we have OHL, we have the CHL, and let's face it, there's a lot of minor hockey. So we can get the hockey culture behind us to say, hey, things have to change. People have to step up to the plate. The government has to be more involved in making the hospitals toe the line and getting organ, you know, transplants out there. I think, you know, there's a need for it. So I'm just doing what I can in rallying Canadians and the hockey fans. Just tell you a quick story. Brazil did it with soccer. They went from like 54th in the world to the top 10. And I think that if Brazilians can do it with their soccer, I think Canadians can do it with hockey. So that's my goal.
The message to increase Canada's donation rates was heard by a packed stadium, who also got the pleasure of seeing their home team beat the Royals 5-3. As much fun as nights like these are, for Schindler, the end goal is to save as many lives as possible.
It takes 2 minutes to register online, and in doing so, you can save up to potentially 8 lives.
For a recipient like Jordan Marcia, those 2 minutes have turned into a lifetime.
Really, it's an opportunity for somebody who's no longer around to be able to help somebody else live their life to the fullest they possibly can. Live life, pass it on.
Thank you, Andrew, Holly, and Sharon. Next up, we have News 101 co-director Sahar Asaf's interview with former Vancouver councillor and co-chair of Women Transforming Cities Society, Ellen Woodsworth. Ellen talks about how cities can better accommodate women and girls.
But first, we're going to take a quick PSA break. Stay tuned for more contributor segments.
Another night's work well done. And so easy without that nuisance Spider-Man.
I didn't know you cared.
You!
Yes, Electro. And I'm going to short-circuit you once and for all.
You would have been better off in the hands of the police. You are no match for my power.
It takes more than power to win. It takes brains and knowing your enemy.
I'll pit my power against your brains any day. What was that?
That, my thieving fiend, is the result of brains.
Use your brain. Turn off all the lights when you leave a room. If every household in BC turned off one light bulb for 4 hours a day for 1 year, it would save enough electricity to power all the homes in Mission for an entire year. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
Why did you start the Women Transforming Cities initiative?
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. Now we have News 101 co-director Sahar Asaf's interview with former Vancouver councillor and co-chair of Women Transforming Cities Society, Ellen Woodsworth. Ellen talks about how cities can better accommodate women and girls.
Why did you start the Women Transforming Cities initiative?
I was a Vancouver city councillor, and I believe that it's really important to use whatever abilities and skills and power you have to make the world work for everyone. And I saw really clearly that women and girls work for cities, but cities don't work for women and girls. And that I wanted to do something to make the city a place where never again would the where you're missing Indigenous women situation occur again.
In your statement on your Facebook page, you've stated that you work to ensure political commitment to addressing and removing barriers that many women face in accessing essential services. Could you talk a little bit about the barriers that women currently face in accessing these services?
Well, because governments don't put an intersectional lens on their budgets, their programs, their policies, their funding, their staffing, or even their having proportional representation at the federal level, which would enable women to run for public office. You don't have that intersectional lens on your work. You're basically looking at government policies from a pretty, white, middle-class, male point of view, and as well as you're looking at cities in a pretty traditional way that doesn't include women's, for instance, unpaid or volunteer work in the community. I think when you look at cities are basically run with a white, middle-class, male lens. And without putting an intersectional lens on the city, you don't actually see the work of women. You don't see the unpaid work in the home. You don't see the volunteer work in the community. And you don't see the fact that often women are having to work one, two, or sometimes even three jobs. And therefore, depending on their race or their income levels, or a number of different factors, you're not developing the policies and programs and services that would enable women to take an equitable participation in cities. So, mm-hmm. for instance, if you look at the need for housing, you know, if we develop housing, major housing projects, what we need is childcare built into them, available for all the citizens that the developers should pay for. That they're using community amenities, building their projects close to public parks or Olympic Village or whatever, then they should be providing those social amenities. If you look at the Greenest City strategy, if you don't look at the fact that 80% of the household decisions are made by women, like recycling and teaching the kids and using public transit, purchasing energy efficient equipment in the house, like stoves and fridges, etc., you're not really understanding how these strategies are going to be implemented. Or if you know, say in the case of Japan, because women's work in the home is invisible, women died after the tsunami. Mm-hmm. You know, they were in the home taking care of the elders and the children, so they were invisible, and they died because of that. So there's all kinds of ways in which green strategies don't work effectively because gender and intersectional lens isn't put on those strategies so that mm-hmm. you see going to implement them and who's going to be impacted by them. So, you know, same thing, public transit, the overwhelming majority of users at night are women because women can't afford cars. Women are often doing the cleaning, or they're working in the bars, or they're doing different things, and yet we don't have nighttime transit, and we don't have frequent transit, and we don't have affordable transit, mm-hmm. and we don't have safe transit, you know, and even at night, when you put the intersectional lens on, you see, you know, majority of those women may be immigrant women. And so do we have the languages of different communities up on the website or on the bus or the magazine for transit? You know, there's just, it's cities, women and girls work for cities, but cities really aren't working for women and girls. And mm-hmm. safety is an issue that we could dissect in the same kind of way.
What are the different kind of issues that women are facing in regard to safety?
Violence generally has gone down since 1980. The only area of violence that hasn't gone down is sexual violence against women. And so, you know, we could look at, you know, the violence within the home, which is a really specific one, and that needs engagement of, I believe, a citywide strategy of violence against women, which is really doable, rather than, you know, one agency or another agency trying to work on bits and pieces of it. The city could coordinate a citywide strategy, and that could include the design of housing, it could include transit, it could include lighting, it could include alarm systems. There's all kinds of things and ways in which we could, if we did a comprehensive strategy. You know, when we did the Hot Pink Paper campaign for the last election, we drew together partners from all kinds of different sectors, you know, immigrant women, Aboriginal women, people for the environment, violence against women, you know, and the violence against women issue, which is, it's all up on our website too, with background papers explaining why the issue and what recommendations we need. One of the things we called mm-hmm. for was this commitment to a citywide strategy, and now we're assessing the commitments that all the parties and the candidates made.
Mm-hmm. So what is your initiative working on at the moment? How are you tackling these issues?
Well, in terms of the Hot Pink Paper, we're now, right at this moment, we're actually talking to all the big parties, the mayoral candidates and the candidates, and pointing out their commitments, which are on our website, and asking what they've done about them and what are they planning to do, because it's less than 2 years for the next municipal election. And then we'll be doing a report card on what we find, mm-hmm. and we'll be getting ready for the next municipal election, The other really big thing we're doing, a number of initiatives actually, is called, we have a 3-year funding to look at systemic barriers to women's participation in local government with the partnership of the Canadian Research Institute for the Advancement of Women and the agreement of the City of Vancouver and the City of Surrey. So we'll look at those systemic barriers to women's participation both within the institution of the city and also the cities as a whole. It's very, very different cities with very different, Surrey's had a woman mayor for at least 12 years, two different women mayors. Vancouver's always only had white men as mayor. Vancouver has all kinds of policies around women's equality and AEO office, but this is only the second time in the history of Vancouver where we've had 50% women councillors, whereas Surrey doesn't have policy, but it's had majority of women councillors for a number of years. So we're going to see what we can do. And then the third thing is we've been very involved with UN Habitat over the past 2 years. And in Quito, we launched what we call the Women Friendly Cities Challenge. And we're working on now getting that online and asking for cities and NGOs to put up wise practices so that we can share them with each other around the world.
And based on your conversations with women in the city, I know that you arrange World Cafe events on a monthly basis. What are the conversations that are taking place, and are there any particular issues that women face that aren't being talked about as much?
Well, I think that, the notion of putting an intersectional lens on the work of cities and doing gender budgeting are really key, because we tend to separate off race from gender or race from sexual orientation, or we seniors from say refugees. We do silos of different issues, but when you put the intersectional lens in, like we've done in the document, Advancing Equity Inclusion, a How-To Guide for Municipalities, we actually offer in that guide, which people can download for free on our website, ways in which cities can look at how racism plays out or has played out, particularly targeting Indigenous women in our cities. Mm-hmm. Or we could at what happens if people who older women come to Vancouver, do they have access to ESL? Mm-hmm. You have to look at the various ways in which power and powerlessness plays out in different communities. So I think that's the importance is not just to look at one issue, but see how the different parts of our lives intersect together and then develop the strategies. And that means having women at the table, having refugee women at the table in the planning of city strategies, and having immigrant women and Indigenous women at the table as you develop whether it's the greenest city strategy or the budget plan or community centers or whatever. You come out with different strategies. There's other groups like ours across Canada. There's the City for All Women Initiative in Ottawa, who've done a lot of really good work with immigrant women. That's up on their website. And the Toronto Women's Alliance has done amazing things. And one of the things they did, some of the women from the Muslim community were saying that they couldn't access the community center pools because there was no privacy. So rather than just saying that's their problem, they put up curtains, and had special times when people could be, the women could use the pool and be in private.
Mm-hmm. When did this happen?
I think that was 2 years ago. It's okay. the Regent Park pool, the new development park. So there's all kinds of ways, if you have people at the table who are saying, look, this is a problem for us, but we have a suggestion of a solution, you can move things forward, but you're not going to do it unless you make sure that people are at the table as you develop the strategy. Even like where the bus routes go, do they go by childcare centers? Do they go by school? Would make a big difference to women who continue to do the majority of the childcare.
Mm-hmm. Do you have like a more recent example of women bringing ideas to the table and how their ideas have shaped or created change in their respective communities?
Well, I think that Sister Watch in from the Downtown East Side is an amazing organization of Indigenous women that grew out of the Walk for Justice, so women who walked to Ottawa and to Prince George to talk about the missing women, Gladys Reddick and Bernice Gundle. They were able to work with the former police chief, Jim Chu, to talk about how the police could listen to Indigenous women and respond and to start addressing systemic racism and sexism against Indigenous women by the actual police force. And then he actually developed a whole commitment around police behavior, but also hiring police officers and getting more diversity there. And Hollerback did some good stuff with BC Transit.
For anyone looking to get involved with Women Transforming Cities, how can they get involved?
Well, we have these projects we're working on. They can go to our website and, you know, they can ask to be. We have a monthly newsletter that goes out. There's volunteer opportunities with the different projects we're working on. And then if they're part of an organization that would like to partner with us on any of this work, or our next cafe is about designing public spaces so they work for women but also named after women. I hope that everyone will join us in trying to make Vancouver a woman-friendly city. It is doable. There is an election coming up in less than a city election coming up in less than 17 months that, you know, we can really shape the policy issues for that election if we all start to talk to people, or if some people might want to run as candidates. So I look forward to hearing from people.
Great. Thank you so much, Ellen.
Thank you, Sahar. It's now time for Alex Norman's weekly financial news report on the biggest finance stories of the week.
This is the weekly financial update report with Alex Norman, keeping you updated with what's going on in the markets. These are this week's top stories for Thursday, March 9th to Thursday, March 16th, 2017. The U.S. Federal Reserve raises interest rates for the second time in 3 months. Intel Corp agrees to buy Israeli self-driving technology firm Mobileye. The Canadian Revenue Agency resumes online services. And oil prices slide to a three-month low on Tuesday. We begin this week's news with the U.S. Federal Reserve raising interest rates on Wednesday for the second time in 3 months, a move spurred by steady economic growth, strong job gains, and confidence that inflation is rising to the central bank's target. The decision to lift the target overnight interest rate by 25 basis points from a range of 0.75% to 1% marks a convincing step in the Fed's efforts to return monetary policy to a more normal footing. Fed Chair Janet Yellen pointed to a growing faith in the economy's trajectory.
The committee has judged that if economic conditions evolved as anticipated, gradual increases in the federal funds rate would likely be appropriate to achieve and maintain our objectives. Today's decision is in line with that view.
The Fed also stuck to its outlook for 2 additional rate increases this year and 3 more in 2018. The U.S. Central Bank lifted rates once in 2016. Have you seen Intel's new ride? It's from Israel. Intel Corp has announced that it has agreed to buy Israeli self-driving technology for Mobileye for $15.3 million US on Monday. The acquisition of Mobileye is expected to propel the world's largest computer chip maker into the front ranks of automotive suppliers at a time when Intel has been downplaying its core semiconductor business. Quote, "This is an area where Intel has had very little presence, so this is a tremendous opportunity for them to get into a market which has significant growth opportunities," said Betsy Van Hees, an analyst at Loop Capital Markets. The $63.54 per share cash deal represents a premium of about 33% to Mobileye's closing price of $47 US on Friday, but is below the all-time high closing price of $64.14 US in August 2015. Mobileye was founded in 1999 and accounts for 70% of the global markets for driver assistance and anti-collision systems. It employs 660 people and has an adjusted net income of $173 million US last year. Shares in Intel closed on Thursday at $35.14 a share for a 2.14% loss for the week. Did someone get hacked? Canadians can file their tax returns online again after the Canadian Revenue Agency took services down as a precautionary measure on Friday. A notice was posted to the agency's website over the weekend, noting that officials had detected a, quote, internet vulnerability and taken many of its services down, including electronic tax filing. The CRA says services were taken offline as a precaution and the website was not hacked. A spokesperson for the agency said in an email on Sunday night that officials were working around the clock to address the vulnerability. Quote, "We are now confident that a solution has been rigorously and successfully tested and services can return online," said Patrick Sampson, a CRA representative. Services returned to normal late Sunday night. Oil prices slide to three-month lows on Tuesday after OPEC reported a rise in global crude reserves and a surprise jump in production from its biggest member, Saudi Arabia. The sell-off sent prices to its lowest level since November 30th, when Saudi Arabia announced that the OPEC nations would be cutting supplies. Brent futures fell below their 200-day moving average for the first time this year, and West Texas Intermediate crude was also down, leading to its seventh straight daily decline, the longest such streak since January 2016. A senior energy analyst at Interfax Energy Global Asset Analytics in London says he's, quote, "worried that a climb in U.S. production could lure OPEC nations to abandon their output cut pledges and could wipe out any possibility for the group to extend their production agreements beyond the original six-month period." Turning to the global markets, these are this week's numbers. Toronto's S&P/TSX Composite Index was up this week with a gain of 0.74% to close at 15,562 points on Thursday. The broader S&P 500 index closed higher this week with a gain of 0.72% to close at 2,381 points on Thursday. The Nasdaq closed on Thursday with a gain of 1.04% for the week. In the European markets, the German DAX closed up 0.87%. In the Asian indices, the Japanese Nikkei posted a gain of 1.05%, and the Shanghai Composite was up 0.59%. In the commodities market, April gold futures closed up this week at $1,226 an ounce. April crude futures were down 0.89% for the week to close at $48.78 a barrel. In natural gas, future contracts were up 1.85% to close at $2.91 a unit. In the bond market, yields for 10-year Canadian bonds are currently at 1.802%. U.S. 10-year Treasury yields closed lower this week at a rate of 2.5366%. This has been the Weekly Financial Update Report with Alex Norman, keeping you updated with what's going on in the markets.
Thank you, Alex. That's our program for March 17th. Today's newscast was brought to you by Talented Volunteer Efforts. If you would like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our Facebook, Twitter, or email us at news@citr.ca.
You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/radio/news/101. You can also find great content on our SoundCloud and Mixcloud pages. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. Today's broadcast was produced by Sahar Asaf and Andrew Seo from the entire news team at CITR. Thank you for listening.
You should come out and see the debates this Sunday. Some of the best debaters in North America. You can volunteer or go for free. It's the Gender Minorities Debating Championships.
The UBC Debate Society secured the bid to host the North American Women and Gender Minorities Debating Championships this year.
after a vote by 22 institutions around the continent. They will be welcoming participants from all debating societies around North America, as well as all members of the UBC community. The tournament final will occur at 3 p.m. on Sunday, March 19th.